Good evening. Come in, won't you? What's the matter? Surely you're not nervous. Perhaps you could come if I tell you a story.
We are met to call from out of the past. Stories, strange and weird.
Tales of mystery and terror by radio's masters of the macabre.
Stories of the supernatural, the supernormal, dramatized by fact, the mystery, the unknown. We tell you this frankly. So if you wish to avoid the excitement and tension of these magic plays, we urge you calmly, sincerely, to turn off your radio now.
This is The Horror. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me this Saturday. We're going to hear from Favorite Story this week, a series hosted by Ronald Coleman that aired over NBC stations starting in June of 1946 till November of 1949. Our story this week is from September 17th, 1949. It's their adaptation of Henry James's The Turn of the Screw.
This is Ronald Coleman inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. Mr. Edgar Bergen chose the favorite story you're about to hear. Many claim that it is the most eerie and harrowing story that was ever written. The Turn of the Screw, by the great American novelist Henry James. Edna Best, who is responsible for some of the most pleasant evenings I have enjoyed in the theater, will be the governess. The tale is told by a man named Douglas, who, on a dreary November evening, was sitting about the fire with some friends. They had gotten on the subject of horror stories. And Douglas, for his part, had remained silent, listening to the others. But when the long pendulum clock in the library told that it was far past midnight, Douglas left the room and then returned to the group a few moments later with an ancient brown envelope. While the others watched in silence, he opened it and drew out a manuscript written in pen and ink in a dainty feminine hand. The pages were thin and yellowed with age. And as Douglas stood with his back to the fire, the light shone through the paper, making it glow with a light which seemed almost its own. My friends, I have listened to your stories with suitable breathlessness, I think. I especially like that tale of Griffin's about the ghost, or whatever it was, appearing to a small boy. But it's not the only case I know of its charming kind, where a dreaded horror touches a child at a tender age. If the child gives the effect of another turn of the screw, what would you say to two children?
Remarkable.
I'd say that two children give two turns.
And we want to hear about them.
Well, my story differs from yours, my friends, in one particular. It is true. It did happen to a very dear friend of mine many long years ago. Well, she's dead now, and in her will she left me this manuscript, which I have never disclosed to anyone until now.
Tell me, sir, do you mind reading it to us?
No, I think not. If you will listen charitably to this story out of the past, when men lived differently, and perhaps more graciously than they do today. She writes, I remember the beginning of my adventures at Bligh with an odd sense of foreboding. I obtained my position as governess by answering an advertisement in a London newspaper.
I seemed to meet the qualifications, and so I traveled into the city for an interview with my future employer. He was very gracious and handsome and pleasant to me. But there was one thing about him that seemed very strange.
You may not wish to accept employment with me when you know one of my conditions.
And what is that, pray?
Never, while you are in my employ, never are you to trouble me.
Why?
Neither appeal, nor complain, nor write to me about anything. Never. Your duties will be light, but you will have complete responsibility.
Are there children?
Two.
I did not know that you were married.
I am not. These are the children of my late brother. I am their guardian.
Oh.
The boy is away at school. You'll have him only during holidays. Little Flora will require lessons, which, as governess, you will provide.
Of course. May I ask, sir, was there a previous governess?
There was.
May I inquire why she left your service?
She died.
Oh.
Now, will you accept my conditions?
I accept.
Excellent. You'll receive all monies for the household from my solicitor.
Tell me, shall I keep a master bedroom always in readiness for you?
That will not be necessary. I never visit Bly.
I hardly knew what to expect at this country mansion which I had never seen. I was half tempted to resign my office before I so much as arrived. And I would gladly give what little I own in this world if I had resigned. If I had never seen Bly. But I did go. And I was agreeably surprised. I remember my first glimpse of the house in the warm summer afternoon. The broad, clear lawn. Bright flowers. Overhead, the clustered treetops. To my young eyes, Bly seemed like the castle of some legendary prince. And I thrilled to think that this mansion was to be in my charge, and within these gates, my word would be law.
Hello. Hello, Miss. We're glad to see you.
Oh, good afternoon. I have the pleasure of addressing
Mrs. Gross.
Oh, of course, you are the housekeeper.
Your room is all prepared for you, ma'am. Tea will be ready in an hour. Oh, we are glad to see you. So glad to see you.
Glad to see me, I thought. Why did this triumphant, forthright housekeeper clasp my hand so? Why was she so glad I had come? She seemed frightened somehow, and relieved to have someone to help her bear the burden of her fear, but what could it be that she was afraid of? There was no mark of it in little Flora. I can imagine no child with a more angelic beauty, a more perfect sweetness in her face and manner. She insisted on showing me all about the mansion at Bly, in a sort of personally conducted tour.
And this is another bedroom.
Oh, it's nice.
And this is Uncle's bedroom.
What a lovely room, and what a pity he never comes to see you.
He never comes. He doesn't like to visit us.
More's the pity. Now tell me, Flora, where do these stairs go?
Oh, you don't want to go up there, Miss.
Why not? Where do they lead?
To the tower.
Oh, there must be a thrilling view of the countryside from the tower.
Must you see it?
Yes. I should love to see it. My little guide in her bright blonde pigtails led me up the stairway to the Tower of Bly, and the view was indeed unforgettable. One could look out for miles on all sides, across the green groves of trees, across the great expanses of lawn and garden, almost to the border of the sea itself. The tower was a square platform, notched with battlements like an ancient fortress. And I felt for all the world like Fair Elaine in Mallory's tale, waiting for Lancelot to ride up to me on horseback along the drive below.
I want to go down now, Missy.
But why, Flora? It's so beautiful here.
I don't know. I want to go down.
I could not imagine why the child did not like the tower. At her age, I would have considered it the most heavenly place for a child to play. And then a strange thought occurred to me. It was not that little Flora herself did not like the tower, but she did not want me to go there.
How are you getting on with the little lady, Miss?
Oh, she is a dear. She is so quick with her studies, and I think she likes me.
I'm sure of that, ma'am. And just wait until little Niles comes home for a holiday from school. He'll win your heart completely. Oh, there's a letter, ma'am, came by the late post. It's from the school that little Miles goes to. It's addressed to the master.
Oh, I'd best to open it, Mrs. Gross. He gave me strictest instructions not to bother him with any details.
Very well.
Well, this is incredible.
What, miss?
From the authorities at his school. They say that little Miles is being sent home.
For a holiday?
No, he's being expelled. They don't want him back. They say he's an injury to the others.
I don't believe it.
Is he bad, Mrs. Gross?
No, never. Little Miles never did an injury to anyone in this world. Why, he's a perfect gentleman.
What could he have done?
Doesn't the letter say, ma'am?
Only that his behavior makes it impossible for the school to keep him on. They're sending him home by coach. He'll arrive tomorrow.
See him, miss. See him first. Then try to believe it.
I was puzzled by all these happenings. Late that afternoon, just as the twilight was settling over Bligh, I went for a stroll to try to clear my brain and think these problems through. The air was crisp and clear. The path where I walked was already in shadow, but the last rays of the sun still touched the treetops and the few clouds high above my head. Slowly, I began to feel an odd sensation, as if I were being watched. And yet there was no one near me. In the garden or along the lawn, I looked back toward the house, and I saw a man in the tower, hatless, watching me from the very tower which Flora had showed me so reluctantly a few days before. I was quite shocked, for I could not imagine who it could be. It was not one of the servants. It was a very strange-looking fellow, tall, with red hair, close curling, and a pale face long in shape. His eyebrows, as red as his hair, were arched, and his small blue eyes stared at me fixedly. Hello? Who's there? Who is it? In the tower? He made no answer. Just looked at me. Then walked along the battlement slowly, following the flat of his hand, the notches in the tower wall. And as I watched, he moved away from me and disappeared behind the battlement. Mrs. Gross, there's a man in this house.
Oh, no, miss. Only the groom and those below stairs.
Oh, no, I saw him. It's not one of the servants. He was in the tower, watching me.
What did he look like?
Well, I saw him quite clearly. He wore no hat, and he had red hair.
Oh.
You know him? A tall fellow, with a long, slender face.
But good-looking.
Remarkably.
With high, curved eyebrows and beady blue eyes.
Yes, that's the man I saw. Oh, you do know him.
Quint.
Quint?
Peter Quint, the master's valet. He never wore a hat. And after the master left, Quint was put in charge.
What became of him?
He went away.
Went where?
He died.
Died?
Yes, Mr. Quint is dead.
This is The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, the favorite story of the famous comedian Mr. Edgar Bergen. The man before the fireplace is reading the words of a dead woman, and his guest, gathered in a circle close about him, listened with rapt attention. It was perhaps a trick of the firelight, or it may have been a tear which fell down the cheek of the storyteller. In any case, he paused in his reading. Shall I go on?
By all means, do. You must.
We must have the ending.
It is rather difficult for me to read this letter, written so many years ago, because I know that the events I'm about to recount for you caused the shortness of her life.
And you loved her?
Yes, I suppose I did. Oh, well, no matter now. The governess goes on to write, I hasten to assure you that my vision of Peter Quint in the Tower of Bligh was not the usual sort of ghost appearance.
There was nothing unearthly about him. To my eyes, he was real. A man of seeming flesh and blood seen clearly in the bright sunset. His every feature was impressed on my eye as on a photographic plate, and every feature that I described was confirmed by Mrs. Gross. There was no doubt. The figure I saw in the Tower of Bly was that of a man who had died 6 months before.
No one knows what killed him, ma'am. They found him at dawn on a winter morning, stone dead at the edge of the road from the village. There was a terrible gash in his head.
He was murdered?
No one knows. The coroner decided he must have slipped on the icy slope and fell, and so cut himself that he died. I only know that Peter Quint was an evil man. He did terrible things, ma'am.
What kind of thing?
Oh, I couldn't put it in words. There are no words for such things. Peter Quint and Miss Jessel.
Miss Jessel?
She was the governess before you came. A wicked woman.
And what became of Miss Jessel?
She went away, too. And she died.
So they are both dead. The pair that used to have charge of this house.
And they had charge of the children, too. Miles and Flora.
Why did the master tolerate such servants, Mrs. Gross?
He has an easy way with him, ma'am. The master never sees the bad in people.
So it seems. Oh, I must be off to the village if I'm to meet the coach with little Miles.
Are you the new governess?
Yes, and you must be Miles.
I'm never so pleased to know you. And it was very kind of you to meet my coach.
Well, it was my pleasure.
May I help you into the carriage?
Why, thank you very much.
You may take us to Bly, driver.
He smiled at me, this little gentleman with the Eton collar and the polished good manners. What could this innocent little gentleman have done to cause the school authorities to expel him? Then, just as little Miles and I came into the downstairs drawing room at Bly, I saw the man again. Peter Quint. In the half-light, outside the window, looking in with his fearful blue-white eyes. Suddenly, like an icy wave, the realization came over me. The dead man, outside the window, was trying to reach the child, to grasp and hold him in his power. For what sinister purpose, I dare not imagine. Can imagine how little I slept that night in Bly. It was one of those feverish summer nights when a person cannot bear the weight of a bedsheet, and a wind hot as from the mouth of a furnace blew through the open casements and down the corridors. Far off, I heard a door slam, and my candle flame bent in the strong draught and went out. In the darkness, I made my first resolve. Whatever evil force was at work in Bly, I would protect my little charges from that evil. Noiselessly, I got out of bed, put on my robe and slippers, and climbed the stairs, intending to look in on the children and see that they were sleeping soundly. From the library, I heard the clock chime the hour. Ever so quietly, I turned the knob of Flora's bedroom door. Flora? Flora? The child was gone. Her bed was empty. And in the broad moonlight by the French windows, I saw a strange woman, gaunt, pale face with a black dress like a shroud, hair as dark as a raven, pulled straight back into a tight knot at the back of her head. Her face was like chalk in the moonlight, and she was laughing with thin, contemptuous lips. At the sight of me, she paused, unfolded her arms, and walked past me through the door so close that I could have and then vanished down the stairs.
Mrs. Gross! Mrs. Gross! Ma'am, now, what's the matter, ma'am? Little Flora has disappeared.
What?
What is it now?
Flora is not in her room.
Oh, she must be there.
Wait, as you came up the stair just now, did you see anyone?
See anyone?
By the light of your candle, did someone pass you going down as you climbed the stairs?
Who, ma'am?
A tall woman, dressed in plain black, with a face like milk and black hair pulled straight back to a knot.
Miss Jessel.
Is that what Miss Jessel looked like?
And thin lips that parted but never showed her
That's
teeth?
The woman. She just left Flora's room and went down this stair.
But Miss Jessel is dead.
So is Peter Quint. But they are both moving into this house. They are after the children, Mrs. Gross.
Why?
The Lord alone knows why.
What's the matter, Missy? Is something wrong?
Flora. Flora, where have you been?
Asleep in my bedroom.
But you weren't there a moment ago. I looked in. Your bed was empty.
I was there all the time. Truly I was.
But I knew the child was lying, for all the innocence on her face. For as I lifted her into bed, I saw blades of fresh-cut grass clinging to her cold little feet. Gradually, I began to realize the spirits of the dead Peter Quint and of the governess who had preceded me were trying to influence and control these two children as they had influenced them in life. I had heard that a strong personality might exert itself beyond the grave and even occupy the soul of a living person. But perhaps the strong will, the spirit of a living being thrown across this terror, might shatter the contact between the children and the evil which threatened them. It must be my will, my living spirit, which would save them.
There. Right under the table.
Oh, dear me. You win again.
Will you play me one more game of checkers? Please, just one more game.
Miles, why don't you ask Peter Quint to play with you? Or Miss Jessel?
They're dead.
But they are still about this house. You see them frequently, don't you? I have seen them, too. The boy's face froze in a sort of blank shock. I went to the casement to see if Flora was still packing flowers in the garden where I had left her. She was nowhere to be seen. Flora!
Flora!
Miles, where has she gone?
I don't know.
You detain me here, playing checkers to give your sister the chance to get away, didn't you? You planned this so that Flora could get away with her, with Miss Jessel. It's true, isn't it? It's true. Where did they go? You know. Where are they?
The lake.
The lake! Flora, where is Miss Jessel?
Jessel?
Yes, and Peter Quint. I saw them both here with you. Where are they?
Oh.
I had never seen such an emotion on a child's face. At the mention of the governess's name, little Flora seemed to grow old before my eyes. I clutched her and her dazed little brother, one in each arm, and pressed them close to me. Then on the other side of the lake, where Miles and I had stood but a quarter of an hour before, I saw the spirits again. Peter Quint! Miss Jessel! I can see you. I know you are there, and I know why you are there. But the terror of you cannot touch these children. I will stand forever in your way. Peter Quint, Miss Jessel, began advancing towards me as if there were no lake between us. Stay back! Stay back! I felt as if a black waterfall were advancing upon me, soon to engulf me in its night. Or that I was standing in the bottom of a pit of evil, and there was no escape, no pinpoint of daylight to give me hope. But I would not yield! But I defy you. My spirit stands between them and you. And I say you shall not touch them. I felt a shock. A shiver passed through the bodies of the two infants, who clung to me with their faces buried in the folds of my skirt. It was a shock as if something had been wrenched out of their little bodies, as if an axe blow had fallen, cleaving in twain the goods
and the bad.
Where did they go?
They have left you. They are gone, Miles. Gone forever.
Arm in arm, the three of us walked back to the mansion house at Bly through the warmth of the quiet afternoon.
So ends The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. Until the day of his death, Henry James was plagued with thousands of letters from curious readers asking what the author meant by this story. Were the ghosts real or only imagined in the mind of the governess? Did the children really see the dead servants? And what was the evil that Peter Quint and Miss Jessel tried to inflict on Miles and little Flora? Well, Henry James replied by saying that he only meant to suggest the horror and to let the reader imagine the evil for himself. Edna Best is to be congratulated for her performance as the governess, and our thanks to Mr. Edgar Bergen for suggesting The Turn of the Screw as his favorite story. Next week, A Tale of Magnificent Irony, The Man Who Corrupted Hadleyburg by Mark Twain. Dennis Day chose this intriguing and delightful story, the story of a town whose foundations were shaken by the vengeance of one man. We hope you'll be listening.
The horror for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find more from Favorite Story at relicradio.com alongside past episodes of The Horror. All the other podcasts, our Shoutcast stream, and everything else Relic Radio. If you'd like to help support this and all of the shows, you can do that from the website as well. Click on the donate link or visit donate.relicradio.com. Your support makes all of this happen. Thanks to those who have helped out. Thanks for joining me today. Be back next Saturday with another episode of The Horror.